A cabinet minister's facing calls to stand down after claims of a foul-mouthed rant at police officers on duty at Downing Street. Andrew Mitchell denies calling them plebs and morons when they refused to let him cycle through the gates, but has apologised to the officers. John Tully, chair of the Metropolitan Police Federation, is appalled.
Someone who holds such high office and apparently holds the police in such contempt is not deserving of such high office, and he should resign.
The Prime Minister's visited police headquarters in Greater Manchester after the death of two policewomen there on Tuesday. He's also met with the families of Fiona Bone and Nicola Hughes. It comes as the man accused of their murders, 29-year-old Dale Cregan, made his first court appearance. Police say they're studying CCTV pictures to investigate a sexual assault on a four-year-old boy in a supermarket. The attack apparently happened in the toilets of an Asda store in Clyde Bank while the boy's mother was waiting for him outside. London Metropolitan University has won the right to a judicial review over the dispute about visas for overseas students. It relates to the UK Border Agency's decision to revoke its licence to sponsor students from outside the European Union. A survey's found a quarter of Alzheimer's sufferers hide their diagnosis because they fear being avoided or treated differently. A campaign's been launched by the government to encourage people who think they have symptoms to get advice. Mark Waltman from Alzheimer's Disease International says we can all help in removing any stigma.
As a personal approach, we should try and make connections still with people with dementia and not avoid them, just talk to them and include them in our everyday life.
A £6 million revival of Jesus Christ Superstar begins its nationwide tour in London tonight. The rock musical, penned by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice in the 70s, is being performed in arenas for the first time ever in the UK. Ben Forster plays Jesus. He was picked from a reality TV show. That's the latest. I'm Kerry Farrell.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Hello, Bristol. Welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and we'll only be doing a short news review this week because we've got a special guest from Oslo, Norway. Activist and blogger Torstein Vidal has been following closely the recently finished trial of last summer's Masonic neo-Nazi killer, Anders Breivik. We'll be discussing with him some of the points missed out by the Norwegian police and often not covered by the mainstream press. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. And in the second hour, after six, well, we often talk on this show about the demise of television journalism. But one investigative series stood out above the others. It led to countless crooks, even international arms dealers, being jailed. 12 years ago, in 2000, Rupert Murdoch's News of the World printed a month-long series of lies about this particular show, and ITV dropped it, refusing to bring it back even after the Murdoch paper admitted that it had been exactly that, a pack of lies. His name, of course, is Roger Cook, and his show, The Cook Report, was Britain's most popular current affairs TV series ever, bringing in an audience around 10 million every week. Well, Roger lives in the West Country, and earlier this week I talked to him about the News of the World and some of the programmes he made before his series was unceremoniously axed. Also, we've got an African guest, Sindani Mako, in town this week. He's been fighting to keep his land in Tanzania. Plus, US filmmaker and director of internet hit Esoteric Agenda, we speak to Ben Stewart, who's in town this week. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, at Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 9 Celsius. This weekend, highs of 13. Sunnier on Saturday, some heavy showers, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs of 16. Very heavy showers on Monday. The rest of the week, sunny spells and possibly a few showers, too. Next weekend, the 29th, 30th of September, highs again around 13 Celsius and fairly sunny next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Helping us review this week's news is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. And before we talk about Norway, let's have a look at some of the stories this week, Martin. What have we got? First of all, 50 more businesses have signed up to the Bristol Pound, which is rather good news. What are your thoughts about this, the launch earlier this week on Wednesday evening? Apparently it was a great success with more and more businesses joining the scheme. But we've had various politicians on here talking about it, and some of them think that it's just really just a glorified voucher scheme.
Well, I mean, these things are either small or more impressive, but nevertheless they're steps in the right direction and therefore to be welcomed. But of course there is a tendency for people to think that these kind of schemes are some kind of solution to the major problems facing the mainstream financial system, and of course that isn't the case. They are steps in the right direction.
Isn't it fair to say that, that by having a Bristol pound, it puts a little bit of pressure on the other pound, you know, that one, to do the right thing and actually to stay as a useful way of keeping value?
Well, there are questions about how this integrates with the mainstream financial system. I mean, things like tax liability and so on, which will have to be ironed out as they go forward.
But that's one of the main things that makes a currency worthwhile, is if you can use it to pay your tax. And the council have said that you would be able to use your Bristol pounds partly anyway to pay your council tax, which has got to be a good thing.
Yes, that will help to underpin it for sure. I wish them every success, and we need to have experiments like this in order to try and localise production and consumption. But let's not kid ourselves, the mainstream financial system is in a terrible, terrible crisis.
Also, the former health minister Paul Burstow has urged the coalition leaders to take on the Treasury to stop George Osborne blocking plans for funding elderly care. Burstow, who was axed in the reshuffle, wants Cameron and Clegg to push through a proposed £35,000 cap on how much elderly people have to pay themselves for care. Now, we've seen some politicians denying this is even taking place, Martin, but quite clearly, in order to fund their care, elderly people, many elderly people, are now looking at losing their homes.
Yes, and I think there's a real problem here, because if you don't, in fact, allow people to keep the money they've saved and invested in their homes and so on, then people are going to stop saving. And in Scotland, of course, the elderly care is paid for by the government by and large. And ultimately, I think we need to go back to having a more collectivist system of provision of all of these things. The idea that we can all privately, individually solve these problems is simply wrong. And there's a huge swathe of people who, I mean, the very poorest people can't save, the very richest people don't need to save, and it's the people in the middle who are making decisions whether to save or not, who basically, unless the state steps in and looks after their care, there's not much point saving their money at all.
But I mean, if someone's got the sort of wealth in their home, maybe £200,000, £250,000 of value, surely they should pay towards their healthcare.
No, not necessarily. I mean, what you should have in a universal healthcare system or welfare system is that everybody pays in and everybody takes out, and everybody is both a contributor and a beneficiary, and therefore that the welfare system is not just for the poor, it's for everybody, and that of course tends to increase social solidarity and basically at the end of the day benefits everybody.
Another cuts related story: the chief fire officers today are warning of potentially catastrophic impact of the cuts. This is from the Independent. Chief fire officers from six of England's biggest metropolitan areas have issued a stark warning to ministers about the potentially catastrophic effect of continued cuts in the service. The brigade leaders from cities including Manchester, Birmingham and Liverpool say more cuts will result in the sacking of frontline firefighters and longer response times.
Well, I mean, we're getting more and more of these reports from various sections of the public sector, aren't we? Fire brigade people, the police, the NHS. I keep making the point that the cuts policy is itself wrong. The deficit is actually creeping up as a result of the cuts policy. This was always absolutely predictable, but most people didn't understand it when this present government came to power. The cuts policy, in fact, is irrational. It's not actually taking us anywhere. The deficit is creeping up because the economy is sliding and it needs to be reversed. They need to stop cutting. And that's not just because of the dangers of fire raging out of control, but simply because it's a stupid policy that doesn't work.
Security firm in the Olympics fiasco spying on the sick in their homes. G4S is targeting insurance claimants. This was in the Daily Mail. The G4S staff are watching injury claimants to ensure they're not faking their conditions, and delivery men are knocking on front doors with secret cameras to film claimants with fake packages to deliver. And the Civil Liberties Group has accused G4S of oppressive and disproportionate behaviour.
Well, G4S, as we know, made a shambles of the Olympics, cost the British taxpayer millions, We need to move away from this whole privatisation of public services. And I presume it's the insurance companies that are paying them to do
well,
this.
Well, it's Zurich Insurance largely is paying G4S to go and knock on people's doors, try and deliver fake packages and make sure they're filming them. Also following people around in supermarkets, this kind of thing.
Well, it's a big brother society that we're moving towards, isn't it?
What's the problem anyway with privatising these policing things? You don't seem to like it for some reason.
Because basically they don't do the job properly and they cost more. It's a bit like the cuts policy. It's not only unfair, it's also irrational. The British taxpayer paid more because they had G4S involved in the security in the Olympics than they would have done if they'd done it in-house all along. So it's not even cheaper. It's more expensive and it's worse. Worse service. We've got to move away from this idea that the private sector is always superior. Largely, it isn't. That's why there was a large public sector in the first place.
Another quite fascinating article by Stephen Glover in the Mail this week. Masters of cover-up, he says. How the establishment closes ranks to protect its own and deny the people the truth. Well, this really, I suppose, contradicts what some of the local MPs in Liverpool and in Sheffield have been saying, that the Hillsborough tragedy couldn't happen today. Stephen Glover says he has believed in Britain's great institutions, but no more. The sand lesson of Hillsborough is that the establishment, that is judges, police chiefs and civil servants, would close ranks to protect their own and deny the people the truth. Cover up, lies, obfuscation and incompetence, these are the defects in the police and ambulance services revealed by this week's damning report, or last week's anyway, into the 1989 Hillsborough disaster in which 96 people died. I mean, he's basically talking about a culture of cover up and also a lack of accountability amongst many of these very important public services.
That is true, and I think in Britain we've had a situation for many years where we make a fetish of secrecy, and when things go wrong, the first instinct is for people to close ranks and refuse to listen to what's being said. And of course also we've got a demonisation of certain social groups going on in the media. So in this particular case it was the Scallies from Liverpool who'd obviously brought the whole thing on themselves by being feckless and what have you. And this is the poisonous side of British society, is this demonisation of out groups and the establishment covering its backside.
And the one, I mean, we were talking about G4S just now, but this is also what we're seeing is the private version of the police spying on some of the most weakest and most vulnerable in society. What on earth is going on?
Well, what's happening is that the capitalist system itself and the profit motive underlying it is in crisis. So the public sphere is being pillaged in order to keep the system going. But of course, that's like eating your own body fat and ultimately you die.
Isn't there some kind of incentive for these insurance companies to be spying on bankers? Maybe they could stand more chance of getting some money out of
them. That's very interesting, because in actual fact, the tax collection people who chase around after the very wealthy are being cut back massively. And we're supposed to have a deficit. The obvious thing to do is beef up your public tax collection system and go after the people who've got the money. And that's not what's happening at all. And that's another reason why the deficit is increasing, which of course is the crucial turning point that we've passed in the last 2 or 3 months. The penny is now beginning to drop. That all of this pain, much of which is still to come, is for no gain. It's a pointless, stupid policy. Austerity doesn't work.
Okay, finally with the news review, we had some fun and games in the House of Commons, anyway some would say that, this week, with the Speaker Burko sacking a local MP actually from Newport, just across the water, Paul Flynn. So let's have a listen to that episode now.
Paul Flynn, the role of our brave soldiers at the moment is to act as human shields for ministers' reputation. The danger to our soldiers is being prolonged by those on that bench who have the power to stop it. Other countries have removed their soldiers from this dangerous area where they're not doing what we're doing, which is arming and training our future enemy. Isn't this very similar to the end of the First World War, when it was said that politicians lied and soldiers died, and the reality was, as it is now, that our brave soldier lions are being led by ministerial donkeys.
Order. Can I just... I've noted what the Honourable Gentleman has said, but can I just ask the Honourable Member for Newport West to make it clear that he's not suggesting that any minister is lying to the House of Commons. It would be helpful if he would make that clear.
That's precisely what I'm saying. I believe we have had lies from the minister, and I believe that our soldiers have been let down, and they can take no confidence.
Order.
In the abysmal performance we had today.
Order. I'm sorry, I asked the question because I wanted clarification, but I'm afraid it is not acceptable for any honourable or right honourable member to accuse another member of lying to the House. And I must ask the honourable
fade Speaker Burko out there, because Paul Flynn, the Labour MP for Newport West, then gets suspended from the House. Martin, what are your thoughts about what he's saying there?
Well, I mean, the obvious immediate context is that he accused ministers of lying, and that's unparliamentary language, and therefore he got suspended. Certain MPs in the past have used being suspended as a way to draw attention to what they're saying, and I think really that's what Paul Flynn was trying to do. And he is, of course, right, in a sense. He's speaking for the majority of British people who've long ago given up on the war in Afghanistan as a hopeless waste of human life.
But the specific context of this is this statement by Philip Hammond around this issue of blue-on-green attacks and the confusion, really, the implication that we were simply being told exactly what we could and could not do by the Americans. And Philip Hammond was sort of tiptoeing around whether or not it was OK to do these joint operations still with the Afghan army.
Well, the Americans have decided to pull out, so if Britain carries on doing it, we'll be the only ones. I mean, everybody knows that the war in Afghanistan has been a catastrophe from the beginning. There's lots of things to be said about it, not just the deaths of young British soldiers, but the deaths of local Afghans. I mean, there was a NATO bombing strike over the week, last week, which killed 8 women and children. Of course, we don't have the same kind of anguish in this country about that as about our own soldiers dying, but perhaps we ought to. The fact is that the intervention in Afghanistan was wrong to begin with, and it's becoming worse by the day, and it's been going on for 10 years. It took the Red Army 10 years to be thrown out of Afghanistan. It looks about the same sort of time for us, doesn't it?
So is Labour MP for Newport West, Paul Flynn, stupid or brave for making the comments he did?
Well, I think somebody's got to say this, because what's happening in the mainstream and the front benches of both the major political parties and the three major political parties is that we've got to carry on for some reason or other which they can't explain to us. The ordinary people, including many military families, have long ago concluded that this is madness and there's nothing to be gained from staying any longer.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, it's now a month since Norwegian neo-Nazi Freemason Anders Behring Breivik was found guilty on multiple counts of murder and sentenced to a minimum of 21 years in prison. But lingering questions remain about Breivik's trip to London in 2002 to meet the founders of the English Defence League and draw up their founding aims and objectives. How Breivik was able to build a small arsenal of firepower and a bomb also without coming to the notice of the authorities, and whether or not, through his secret Masonic brothers or online network of thousands, he was encouraged or aided in July 2011 in the massacre of the 77 people in one day. The ramifications of this are enormous, because Breivik potentially exposes a whole new side in the war on terror, a clandestine group of religious fundamentalists who see themselves as vigilante guardians of the home front in the war on terror, and may even be connected to NATO's secret army of fascists who've been killing civilians in Europe and blaming those atrocities first on the Soviet Union and then domestic left-wing groups and Republicans and even more recently Islamic fanatics. So, to take a trip down this particular rabbit hole, I'm joined by Torstein Vidal, who's an activist and blogger from Oslo. Hi Torstein, welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, thank you.
First of all, Torstein, can you just give us a bit about your background, your work for the TV people, broadcasting company over in Norway, for example?
Yeah, I used to work for the NRK internet pages in 98-99 as a project developer.
And the UN, and also, I understand, telecoms companies.
Yeah, I've been working for Yahoo and for United Nations Association of Norway, but currently I'm self-employed and establishing my own IT business.
Okay, now the thing is, you actually live in Oslo, in central Oslo, and as I understand it, you actually were there and you experienced the attack itself.
Yeah, I was at home working in my home office, and I thought it was some kind of lightning and thunder, you know, knocking my window out in my living room. And I just instinctively went out with my camera to take pictures of the damages and all the broken glass in the center. Yeah.
Okay, so you actually went out and took pictures. What did you see once you came out of the of your flat? What was how close were you to the actual bomb itself?
Yeah, I live on the, you know, like 200 meters from the government building, so a lot of glass even after one street or one quarter, and the whole central downtown area was just smashed. All the windows were smashed. And I took about 50 pictures of that in, well, in the first hour.
Yeah. I know that some of those are online, so what we'll do after the show maybe is just put a link, if people want to have a look, on this show's webpage, which is at thisweek.org.uk. We'll put a link up later this evening so people can have a look at those photos, just, you know, from your own experience. Now, you know, your commentary online and elsewhere about 22/7, because it was the 22nd of July, diverged quite a lot from what the mainstream media was saying and the police, government, this kind of thing. At what point did you start to think, you know, maybe that the official story was starting to creep off in a direction which was a bit too far from the truth for you?
Oh gosh, that's difficult to remember the exact point. Next question, please.
Well, was it very quickly? Was it a few months afterwards?
I think maybe during the first 3 weeks or something.
And what was, you know, what kind of you know, indications were there that, you know, we weren't getting the whole story?
The first indication for me personally, I think, was that our Prime Minister Stoltenberg, he would go out in the first couple of days and grant everybody more democracy and more openness. And the first thing I experienced is that my article or blog piece to the Labour Party daily newspaper gets denied and deleted, and I get blacklisted for essentially for life just for suggesting some you know, some historical parallels for the date 22/7, for instance.
Okay, well, tell us about that date, because this is a date for most people. 22nd of July doesn't mean anything. It might be somebody's birthday, but is there some sort of historical context to that date?
Yes, very much so. It's considered the birthday of international terror. If you look to the Middle East, you had, before the State of Israel was created, you had Zionist terrorists who blew up the British government building in Jerusalem on 22nd July 1946, dressed as Arabs, and they killed about 91 people, innocent people working in the hotel.
Martin, maybe you could just come in here. What was the significance of this attack on the King David Hotel? Could it really be said as the post-war birth of terror, international terrorism?
Well, I mean, it's clearly a terrorist incident, and it does no harm to remind people that the State of Israel was founded by terrorists, as was the State of Ireland, for example. I mean, terrorism has been with us for a long time, and it's not always coming from the direction people expect.
And how important was the attack on the King David Hotel in sort of pushing the British to give up on Palestine?
Pretty important. It was a fairly clear indication that they were going to have to take heavy casualties if they were going to stay. And don't forget, in 1947, Britain had just finished World War II. The stomach for lots of casualties, lots of secretaries and so on were killed, young people, young girls. And the British public just said, well, we're not sticking around for that. And, of course, the same sort of sentiment is now being said about Afghanistan.
Okay, I can see why you would get suspicious if you're just pointing this out as a historical, something which is potentially historically significant, you've then been censored. But anyway, so let's have a look at some of the stuff which has come out more recently, particularly the weeks before the attack and events before the attack. Where did Breivik live and actually build his bomb in the run-up to the Oslo attack?
Yeah, I've been doing some research on that, and in the vast ocean of information about the 22/7 terror, I recently stumbled upon the facts regarding Anders Breivik's peculiar choice of location for his bomb factory. Not only was Volstua Farm in Rena situated very close to the Rena military base, the main army base in southern Norway, it was also rented from a guy who used the farm as a cannabis plantation, and who was a convicted bank robber in the famous 2004 Nokas case, where a major bank was robbed and a policeman shot dead. You would think Anders Breivik was able to find a suitable farmhouse closer to Oslo with less criminal history and fewer reasons for police inspection.
Right, so that's quite interesting that he should choose such a place. And I wonder, you know, but and also, obviously, he's renting it off of someone who has connections to a criminal gang. Obviously, there would be, I would have thought, some sort of police surveillance of this. Now, wasn't there also, see, this military base being right nearby may have no significance, but I understand that there was some sort of fertilizer bomb, which exactly the kind of bomb that he used in Oslo, a test just before the Oslo incident last year, or around about the same time, on the base.
No, you're talking about the earthquake in the Rena area.
Yeah,
I don't think that's related. I mean, that's a huge, giant earthquake. I cannot really relate that to the planning of the terror.
Okay. Mm. What about the bits for the bomb? Because I understand he got some of the bits for the bomb he used from Poland, and that there should really have been some kind of surveillance of that, because these pieces were known by the authorities to be possibly used in bomb making.
Yeah, they were his buying of the detonators, or the parts for the detonators for the bomb from Poland, was reported, as it should be, to the Norwegian customs. And then the customs is part of Global Shield, which is a terror, anti-terror program, reported these things to the Norwegian security police, the PST. The problem with the PST was that they took about 8 months reading that email from the customs office, which meant that the first time the PST security police looked up Breivik's name in their database was on 22nd July 2011, which is a bit too late, I find.
Well, the same day as the attacks.
Yeah.
Okay, so Martin, this is pretty crazy, isn't it, that the one side is not talking to another. Now, actually, what are your thoughts about, you know, whether this is normal in these kinds of situations, whether information is flying around? I mean, maybe comparing it to other terrorist attacks we've seen, whether the authorities are really functioning well together to protect us.
Well, I think there are two sorts of strands of questions, isn't there? One is, perhaps he should have been picked up, so it's a question of competence and incompetence and whether it's being properly done. But as we know from the civil war we've had in Ireland and Britain over the last 30 years, there's also a lot of manipulation. So, for example, if you've got an informant inside a terrorist group, often you won't pass information about what they're telling you to other agencies because you want to protect your informant, and that's another level. And then there's a third level where you're actually encouraging terrorism, where the intelligence services become suspects. And this, of course, links in with the Gladio story that you mentioned at the beginning of the hour, which, of course, we've got overwhelming evidence that Western intelligence services, probably including the Norwegian intelligence services, but certainly including the British, have been involved in promoting terrorist acts in Western Europe in the recent past. And this isn't conspiracy theory, this is history. Not well-known history, because the mainstream media doesn't dig it up, but anybody who wants to look into Gladio simply has to make a computer search on the word Gladio, and they will see that the Western intelligence services are suspects in many terrorist attacks. Now, that doesn't mean they did this attack, it just means that that's one of the questions that any police officer investigating it should bear in mind.
Well, nobody's perfect. Even the secret counterintelligence police, one can forgive a few mistakes. But Torstein, you've identified something like 15 mistakes in the police and the anti-terror police's account of events. Because am I right in thinking that the commission that looked into this has reported just before the end of the trial? Now, I suppose the first question really is, how was the commission's report received by the families and people generally in Norway when that came out? Because that was separately running parallel to the trial.
Yeah. The report was received with shock because it detailed so many fatal mistakes by the police and by the security services. But it was also received as a very good and thorough report, which means that we finally got a collection of all the relevant events and mistakes and all the relevant information about this whole event.
Okay, so I was glad the families at least have received it well, and they think it's a good report. Anyway, you, I know, have picked out around about 15 what you call fatal mistakes that are revealed by that report. So can we go through those now?
Yeah. You know, after the fertilizer bomb exploded in Oslo's government quarter, police made the stunning series of unbelievable mistakes. Maybe all of them were not unbelievable in themselves, but understood as an array of errors that certainly raised a lot of questions. These fatal mistakes hampered the efforts to stop any secondary attacks in the first phase, you know, after the bomb, and they slowed down the rescue operation when the island massacre was a known fact. So this following list is quoted directly from the official 22/7 Commission report issued by the Independent Commission on August 13th. I'm quoting now from page 86. At 15:35, 10 minutes after the bomb, a witness reported that he'd seen a person in a police uniform with helmet and pistol that had driven away in a car with registration number VH24605. The police did not manage to make use of this information. Page 88, several neighboring districts offered to send police patrols to assist, but the operation central replied that there was no need at the time. Page 90, the operation central did not push the big red button, as they'd been told by the task force leader. Page 90, the
Big red button is what? It's some national system for kind of coping with the terrorist attacks.
You know, national alarm and the neighboring police districts, you know, the whole enchilada. So the police helicopter that in this commission's opinion would have been a considerable resource was not attempted mobilized. Neither were any other helicopter resources, military nor civilian, attempted required. This even though the Delta Force, the anti-terrorist force staff, at two occasions had requested an operational level on an operational level for mobilization of the police helicopter. So the central operation command turned down twice the request from the anti-terror police to use the helicopter, which was readily available. Page 91, you have no roadblock or observation posts were established. After the explosion, there was apparently no consideration of the possibility for sending out a national alarm, the big red button. Neither was there any initiative to activate the set of terror plans. The witness information on the suspect and his car was not read out on the communication system until about 17:47, which is more than 2 hours after the tip. This information was also not given to the media for alerting the public through radio and TV. The road traffic central in Oslo, which has a vast network of cameras, were also not warned. And still on page 91 of the report, the commission has all in all found very few traces of operational action for avoiding or preparing for possible secondary attacks. In the Commission's opinion, such action in the local and neighboring districts, combined with warnings through media, would have raised the awareness of the public and made other police districts better prepared if anything were to happen in their area. Further, the Commission thinks such actions could have led to the suspect in his car being detected. So, carrying on page 93, not until 17:00, the task force leader and operational leader had their first phone contact. They didn't even speak to each other, you know, in Oslo. And in the opinion of this commission, the operational leader did not manage to enter the leadership role and be the decider that this role implies. And then you have another commander named P3. P3 gave orders for securing the police house to avoid the police being knocked out. He did not consider implementing any kind of roadblocks or control posts to catch possible suspects fleeing the scene, something that could have been done through assistance from neighboring police districts. Page 96, neither did the chief of staff get any information about the received witness statement about the car registration number. The police district, in other words, changed the leadership on the operational level without going through the information of a possible terror suspect and without going through the status of the operation thus far. At the next staff meeting, starting at 17:25, the staff did still not know anything about the witness information. That's 2 hours after the tip was called in, and was not informed about this at the meeting. The staff log says that P2 reported that no particular traces are being followed other than the YouTube tip. No witnesses to this point. So it's very bad information internally in this operation, obviously. Page 100. At 15:56, an operator at the operation central phones back to the witness that had at 15:34 reported this observation of VH-24605. The operator had by coincidence discovered the note, which had been lying on the operator desk beside her, and understood the contents to be very important. Now, I got loads and loads of more points, but this gives you an impression of the kind of mistakes that have been made here.
Yes, I mean, it does sound like a real incompetence, particularly the idea that after such a massive terrorist bomb attack, that the police, Martin, would refuse the assistance of neighbouring forces.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's just put this in context of how people might see this who are listening. Norway's not really used to terrorist incidents. I mean, in Belfast, they're used to terrorist incidents, so there's a whole procedure for dealing with them. And, of course, people might say, well, this is just the Norwegian police being Norwegian police, who are not really that clued up about this kind of thing. I think that's a legitimate kind of comment to make, and, of course, that's an issue for the reform of Norwegian police in the future. But, of course, the bigger, most important question has to be asked is, what help did Breivik have? What was his networks? Who was he working with? And we know that he was working with other far-right groups. That's established, including the English Defence League here, who, of course, have tried to distance themselves from him. What more concerns me is there any outside intelligence service involvement in this? And that could be any intelligence service. Yeah, we could be talking here about the Russian intelligence services, for example, as we might be in the case of Litvinenko, or we could be talking about the Western intelligence services, but that's certainly an issue that should be in people's minds. Because, of course, the political impact of this was enormous. You've basically killed off a whole generation of young Labour activists in Norway who had great futures in front of them. Several of them were councillors. Many of them would probably have ended up as MPs, probably have ended up in the government, because the Labour Party in Norway has been historically a hegemonic force. It's been a major force in the country. So somebody didn't like them. Breivik clearly didn't like them. He was quite clear in everything that he said, that he hated them for their Marxist politics and their multiculturalism and all the rest of it, all of which is so obvious and so nasty. The question is somebody else behind Breivik? And I think that is a legitimate question, because we know in the past that a strategy of tension has been used in Western European countries, including Italy, Belgium, and other countries in Western Europe, in order to create certain political effects desired by the powers that be, if you like. And I think these are the questions that have to be asked. And they are the questions that would be asked in Belfast as well. Of course they would.
Okay, now, one of the things you mentioned there was the links with the English Defence League, Martin. Now, Breivik visited London in 2002, we know, met with a group of people to draw up the aims and objectives for the English Defence League. I understand also, Torstein, that there's a kind of Norwegian equivalent.
Yeah, you got the Norwegian Defence League. You know, its name is even in English, so it's clearly just a local shop of the EDL. And yeah, that they're not a very, very big group, but they have been having a couple of demonstrations in different cities in Norway.
Okay, and also setting up this thing called the Knights Templar Network with somebody who goes by some sort of code name Lionheart. No one's quite sure who this is as an individual, but certainly the Daily Telegraph has implied that it could be someone called Paul Ray, who was associated at the beginning, and he used the same handle online. as a sort of screen name for him, and he has now decided he wants nothing to do with the English Defence League, and he's moved off to Malta. Martin, this does sound like it's some sort of part of some sort of much wider sort of crusader network. Well, that's what these people call themselves anyway. They're crusaders, in a way, a bit like the medieval crusaders, and they even call themselves the Knights Templar.
Yeah, well, what they're doing is taking a bricolage from history to prop up their present prejudices. But clearly, we're talking about a network, not just an individual. So that's the first point that's been established beyond a shadow of a doubt. Now, if the police were doing their job properly, they should be chasing that network down. What are the linkages? Where else can we expect attacks to come from? If this was the UDA, the UVF, or the IRA, that's exactly what we would be saying. Now, what seems to have happened is that there's an attempt to just put Breivik in a box as a crazy individual, and therefore there's no consequences to flow from this. There's no political implications. It's just a crazy individual. It's a very sad situation. He's in prison now. Let's forget about it. But it seems to me that there are clear political dimensions to this, and we've got to ask ourselves the question, so who's behind Breivik? Just we have to ask ourselves, who's behind Osama bin Laden? Who's behind all of these other people that we claim to be fighting and opposing? Although and we know, and we've established over many years, that Western intelligence services, and not just Western intelligence services, the Israeli intelligence services, the Russian intelligence services, they all engage in false flag terrorism. It's a standard procedure. The question is that the case here? And I'm not saying it is or it isn't. It's just a question that has to be asked.
Well, one particular angle to all of this, of course, is, and you Martin, talking about possible clandestine people he was associated with, is his membership of the Freemasons. Well, quite clearly, he's in at least one Masonic lodge where he's in the same lodge as somewhere about a dozen, at least, other Freemasons. I wonder, Torstein, did this come out at all? Did they actually start looking into the other Freemasons, individuals who he was secretly associated within those Masonic lodges, and even questions like how many lodges he was actually a member of?
No, there was very little writing about the Freemasons. Just, you know, the mention of it the first day, and no police or judicial investigation of the Masons themselves has been heard of anyway.
Okay, you know. And it, but he was a Freemason. He did admit to visiting the Oslo Masonic Temple four times, apparently. I mean, what was known about that?
Yeah, it came out in during the court case that his total amount of visits to the lodge was four, and that was exactly the same amount of times he was promoted in the Masonic system, which sounds a bit strange.
Well, I'll tell you why it sounds strange, is because usually there will only be one lodge meeting a year which allows a promotion, and you will only get promoted if you've been going along regularly to lodge meetings throughout the year. So, I mean, that immediately on the face of it sounds very strange. It sounds like a possible lie, you know, that he's only been to the initiation meetings. Well, he's not really likely to be promoted through the Freemasons if he doesn't attend during the rest of the year. So they haven't really investigated that. Martin, this is another indication that there's some secret liaisons that haven't been looked at by the police. And is it possible, for example, that there were policemen in his Masonic lodge?
Well, I don't know, but what we do know is that Propaganda Duo, the Masonic lodge at the heart of Italian terrorism, has been established for many years, that it had all of the top intelligence people, industrialists, military in Italy in it, and it was definitely behind the strategy of tension in Italy, which involved the bombing of Bologna railway station that killed 80 odd people. Now, this is all historical fact, and when we find that this individual, who is not just a crazy individual, has got networks into Freemasonry, that rings a bell. That brings definitely rings a bell. The fact that he's working with far-right extremists, that rings a bell, like the far-right groups in Italy, which were used as a means for carrying out terrorist attacks. And all of these things smell to me very much like a Gladio-style hit. And, of course, the purpose of it, you could then speculate, well, what's the benefit of this? Well, it kind of terrorises the Norwegian Labour Party, doesn't it? It sort of puts them on the back foot.
Torstein, can you just tell us how's the Norwegian Labour Party doing right now? Because one would have thought, from this distant point of view from England, that, you know, probably because of the attack, there's a lot of sympathy and that they probably do quite well in the polls because they've been attacked by this guy.
Yeah, you know, they did very good in the polls last year and in last year's regional election. The far right parties went behind, and the Social Democrats, the Labour Party, you know, made a huge jump in the election. But you know, things changes in politics. So this summer we've seen the opposite effect, because, of course, having ruled Norway for such a long time, the Labour Party gets a lot of the blame for this pure security, this lax security in Oslo, and the bad handling of the massacre. So, in fact, the two parties to the far right, the Conservatives and the Progress Party, have well above 50% of the votes in the polls these days, and they continue to step ahead of the socialist
side. Yeah, it sounds like the Labour Party's almost got the blame for this attack, and after the end of the court case. Anyway, Martin, you were talking there about this Operation Gladio. You're talking about the P2, and I know you, Torstein, wrote about the man behind Breivik. You know, you're one of these people that thinks that he didn't act just on his own, that he had all sorts of connections that were, whether actively or just by encouraging him, supported him in some way.
Yeah, I agree with Martin that at least you have to consider the possibility that there is a gang of criminal or intelligence people behind Anders Breivik, because you've seen that again and again and again in European history, and also in American history and Asian history. You have had Gladio terrorism in Turkey, which is
Gonikon, as they call it, isn't it?
Yeah. And you also have terrorist attacks like 9/11 in America, and Bali bombing. So this kind of thing goes on all the time.
We're saying that a lot of these terrorist attacks have elements quite potentially of the Western intelligence services really just trying to cause trouble and blame the attack on their enemies. Well, you won't find this being marketed in front of your nose in Waterstones. Too much financial power at stake for that. I'm talking about the first book by a British journalist about NATO and our armed forces doing precisely what our mainstream media are so good at accusing Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi and Assad of doing, that is, blowing up their own people, and that means us. The book is Gladio, NATO's Dagger at the Heart of Europe, the Pentagon, Mafia, Nazi Terror Axis. It's about modern European terrorism. The author is former member of the European Parliament for Bristol and one-time editor of the British Aircraft Corporation's in-house magazine, Richard Cotterill, and I spoke to him a couple of months ago about the transition from these attacks being about the former Soviet Union to now about Islamic terrorism. One of the other things you talk about, you think that this whole business of the sort of anti-Soviet invasion force was also then sort of moved on to another target, which is the Islamic fundamentalist type terrorism.
Yeah. I'm always, to use probably an inappropriate word, amused by this, because in terms of terrorism, you must look to NATO itself for its invasions of the Balkans in order to destroy a united Serbian state. The purpose of this was to break it up into little pieces so that one by one they could be absorbed into the European Union, whereas absorbing one large state like Serbia would cause severe political problems. Then we have 9/11 and the attack on Afghanistan, and God knows how many millions have died there now. Iraq, of course, where we know the United Kingdom was taken into a scrap on entirely fabricated intelligence concerning weapons of mass destruction. So the terrorism comes from us, not the other way around. This is the difficulty. The second point is that, in a sense, this was only a halfway house. Still we have the Islamic peril, Shia law, minarets replacing parish churches. But in fact, the new target is a completely different one altogether. Now it's anarchists and those who are against the state, anti-establishment figures. These are the ones who are now causing trouble, like the riots in London and so forth. And it's not just in the UK where this argument is portrayed. It's also copied in Germany, it's copied in the Netherlands, it's all over the United States of America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Greece now, for example, where it's perfectly obvious that due to the Bilderberg Trilateral Commission EU attempt to destroy the country's economy, then much of the violence which is appearing there is in fact stoked by official sources.
Now, we hear about people like Bashar al-Assad and Colonel Gaddafi attacking their own people, bombing their own people. This is one of the key ideas which is used to galvanise British political and public opinion behind foreign wars nowadays. I mean, are you saying that you believe that for decades, and maybe even beyond that, that the British government and other NATO governments have been doing this?
Yes. If we look at the Libyan episode particularly, I remember, because we all have such short memories, but I rather think yours is not like this, but certainly the mainstream media does, of Tony Blair making his extraordinary mission to Libya, his odyssey across the parched desert, until he last comes upon the brooding black spider, Gaddafi, and tells him that he's no longer world terrorist suspect number one, but a Western ally and supporter. This is exactly the same man who was murdered by Western military forces and agents. It's, I think, indisputable that much of the violence in Libya was in fact stirred by secret forces which were on the ground, principally, I think, the CIA, but definitely supported by French, Italian, and British intelligence. The existence of secret forces is past disputing. We are seeing exactly the same things in the Assad affair in Syria at the moment. So when you want to achieve something these days, you have to convince people that there is something horrid and terrible going on, so that you can then justify the wonderful idea of humanitarian intervention. This was the song that was sung during the Balkans. This was the song that was sung in Afghanistan. It is the song which is now sung in Iraq, still continuing despite between 600,000 and a million perfectly innocent people having died, and at least 4 million more fled altogether. Now we hear it again with Syria. Where next? Will it be Iran next? Probably, I think, yes.
Well, I think it's very interesting hearing Richard Cottrell there, who was a Conservative member of the European Parliament and a professional journalist. And of course, people on that level actually get more information than your ordinary people, and they actually understand more of what goes on. But of course, it's only on radio shows like this where we talk about it. The mainstream, if you talk to mainstream journalists about these things, they look at you blankly and you just think, it's all there, open source information, but you're not interested in looking at it. Why not? Of course, the big exception to that is people talking about what's been going on in Ireland. In other words, when we were talking about the business in Norway, I was thinking of the Omar bomb in Ireland, where it was quite clear that there were infiltrators inside the real IRA who were passing information back to the IUC special branch about the bomb, including the exact number of the car and exactly when it crossed the border, because Kevin Fulton, as his pseudonym was, had given all the information to it, but they let it through and they let the bomb go off. And Nuro Lone, who was the head of the Northern Ireland police ombudswoman, was looking into that, and there are questions about it. How come that bomb got through when they had all the information they needed to stop it? How come the bomb got through in Norway, and how come he then drives off to the Labour Party summer camp and kills 70 odd people before anybody turns up to stop him? I mean, and I also understand that some people were saying that perhaps more than one person was involved. I don't know whether that's true, but these are the questions that have to be asked when these incidents occur. That occasionally you do find crazy individuals who do crazy things, usually there's more to it.
Well, what about the philosophy of Anders Breivik? One of the articles you wrote on your blog, Torstein, was this linking Zionism and Nazism. Now, one would think initially there's no way you can link the two, because Zionism is a Jewish thing, and Nazism, there's no way that you can be, you know, a Zionist and a Nazi at the same time. Impossible.
Yeah, this was something I heard directly from Anders Breivik himself on the second day of the trial. He had this defense speech, and he there laid out sort of his game plan for creating a mass movement of sorts by extremists. And the thing is, he knows that in order for this movement to be a big movement, he has to sort of flirt with the traditional neo-Nazi subculture and get them on his side as well. Even though, you know, for a neo-Nazi to support his Zionist action plan would be some kind of self-betrayal for a real neo-Nazi, I guess.
Well, one of the other areas of collaboration of one sort or another is in New York, and this organisation called Stop the Islamification of America. And we're going to hear now from someone with a blog called Atlas Shrugs. And her name is, she's one of the spokespeople for this organisation called Pamela Geller, speaking about the mosque which is apparently about to be built at Ground Zero. So let's have a listen to her.
Ground Zero Mosque. Ground Zero Mosque. I was writing about the Ground Zero Mosque. Media wasn't touching it. No. Media wasn't touching it. I was writing about it in November 2009. But my readers were sending it around, and people were saying, Ground Zero Mosque. Even if you didn't have a cursory knowledge of Islam, on its face, it was deeply offensive, humiliating, an abomination, outrageous, that a 15-story mega mosque would be going up in a building that was destroyed by the landing gear of the plane that went into the towers. Wait, it gets better. It's named Cordoba. Cordoba, the golden age of Islam. Yeah, the golden age of Islam. Golden for Muslims, maybe. But in 711, when Muslim armies invaded Spain, which was a collection of Christian kingdoms, and the Christians and the Jews were living under dimitude, a subclass status, denied basic human rights, it was anything but golden. And it was the site of not just one, but two, the first Jewish pogrom of two. Cordoba. Get it? That would have been Mecca on the Hudson. And when we held our first rally on June 6th, D-Day, that was deliberate June 6th, we had 10,000 people there. So the media couldn't ignore it. And then it began. And that's why this movie that you're seeing, and I want you to buy this movie, and I want you to show it in your living room, and I want you to invite your friends, and I want you to make popcorn or whatever it is you do when you're not working. I don't know. All I do is this work. But... and show it. So you see how the story arches, how they ignored it, how when they couldn't ignore it anymore, and it became, because of you, without the media, not only the number one national news story, but the number one international news story.
Well, that's Pamela Geller from Stop the Islamicization of America. Martin, you were sort of chuckling, but I mean, actually what she's saying, again, is re-emphasizing this whole thing about the original Templars going back in history, looking at, you know, sort of other events that have happened in the past and trying to make some sort of historical connection between the modern crusading movement against Islam and back in the old days, back in medieval times.
Well, we could just critique her historiography because it's totally failed, but what's really worrying is this sheer... brass neck provocation of this kind of talk. And of course, it's not just mad people like her talking, there are also people who are using extremism, Muslim extremism and anti-Muslim extremism. And interestingly enough, the English Defence League are very pro-Israel. They carry, you know, that fascism is changes its spots but remains the same. And what we're actually talking about is that this film's clearly been made by another group. It's not just an individual, and it's been used in order to create incidents which then allow interventions in countries you want to intervene in. And that's what we're really talking about here. We're talking about powerful people at the very top working through the intelligence services to stage incidents so that we end up in wars where they can get what they want, which is invading various countries and dominating their natural resources.
Torstein, can I just ask you to finally just round up with let us into your blogging world. Whereabouts can people find you online?
Well, they can find me on Google Plus, I think is the place I blog most of the things about 22/7, and also on the 22/7 Facebook group.
Okay, so Google Plus, what about, isn't it 9/11 Truth Norway?
No, yeah, I think you have to write it on your web page.
Okay, know. And it's TorsteinVidal. Thanks very much for joining us. Time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to this week's guest, and that was Torstein Vidal from Norway. After the news, it's Roger Cook.
BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.